Hi and welcome to episode 23 of the Carlton podcast, The Two Tones. Tony DeVolfo.
Greetings, Tony. How are you?
I'm very well, and I'm Tony Moakley. 23. Come on, where do you start?
Well, I know where you're starting, but I can't go past Jakob Viertering, the keeper of the number 23.
Rice.
Well, he was a great player, Dean Rice, wasn't he? I can still see Tony again. I think it must have been 94. My memory might be playing tricks, but could be earlier, where Dean Rice went over on his knee at half-time of the match against Richmond, I think it was, the MCG. And I can remember David Parkin going over there when the players broke up for half time and saying to Dean Rice, "You're the best thing that's happened to Carlton, you know, in the past 3 years," and sort of really gave him that vote of confidence in that shocking moment that Dean Rice needed to actually claw his way back, overcome the knee, and become part of the record breaking 95 Premiership team. So. Just goes to show, doesn't it? All is not lost. It's never as bad as it seems. You know, there is a way back, isn't there?
We owe an enduring debt of gratitude to St Kilda for Dean Rice. Absolutely great player.
Great footballer.
Loved watching him play. Now, if I'm not mistaken, Molly Meldrum also wore the 23.
Yes. I mean, famously, or legend has it, walked it off the street to...
He rode his bike to Princess Park and joined the club.
Why doesn't that happen anymore, Tate?
Oh,
you know, I know you ride the push bike in, don't you? Have you ever had thoughts to bring your boots with you one day? Or?
I think we're in enough travel time. I was fortunate enough to sit next to Molly at a club function once. Fascinating individual, smart man.
Yes.
And he was great company, can I just say.
That great fellow, and he was a runaway leader, wasn't he, in the Brownlow, I think, of 1987, memory serves.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, you know, he was involved in that accident that Peter Motley was lucky to emerge from alive.
He and Craig Bradley.
Molly was in the car,
but
he was an absolute tearaway leader for a period, and they caught up with him in the end in that year. But he was a fascinating player because he wouldn't say a big frame player, but the thing with Molly that I remember most was that you couldn't lay a tackle on him.
Mm.
He had this great capacity to shrug tackles, and you know, the great Alex Jezelenko will. I'm sure we'll talk about it a little bit later with our special guest.
Yes.
He was prodigiously strong through the core as well, and no one could bring the bloke down. And that's probably what I remember about Molly.
Terrific player, great number 23, of course. Now, Tone, we are reviewing round 22, the match against the Bulldogs. It was a 17-point loss at Etihad Stadium, 7-7-49 to 10-6-66. You talk about laying tackles. There are a few that didn't stick on the weekend. There was a couple of heartbreak. Well, I don't know. Some of the umpiring, I was left scratching my head at, and crucial moments that you could say almost swung the game. I don't want to, you know, I'm a stuck record with that sort of thing, but Carlton were valiant, and I thought we were going to win at one point.
Dennis Pagan famously said, "Tony, never worry about things you have no control over."
Yeah,
and
it's
good advice. It's sage advice from Dennis. Yes. But look, I feel your pain. I do. I think we were knocked over on the outside, though. I think the Bulldogs' run was something that we just weren't able to counter. And you know, seeing Joe Hansen just flying off half back, what a great player he is. Mm. And thinking about Tony, who we didn't have as rebounding defenders. Now, Kieran Byrne, in fairness to him, is really giving us that run that we've needed. But then when you think of, you know, the Docks hasn't been there all year, nor has Williamson. Williamson's another rebounding defender. How much better our team would be with those two players going around. So, look, you know, we're crawling to the line. You know, there's about eight players that have for some time been done for the year. But in saying that, the players are hanging in. You know, it'll be easy for the psyche of the players to be elsewhere at the moment. I suppose you're thinking of Mad Monday and trips away. But you know, to Bolton's credit, the players remain committed to the task. And let's just hope against the Crows they can finish on strongly, because we want to go into 2019 with some momentum, Tone.
Well, absolutely. A couple of mentions in dispatches. Ed Curno, thought Marchbank's game was terrific. Some of those intercept marks were fantastic.
Superb.
Simo, my God, that man needs to be captured, either bred in captivity, or studied, because he's a freak. Cripper, absolutely amazing. Do you know that? I mean, the takeaway moment, Charlie's goal, but the reaction to Tom De Koning, TDK, he did amazing things to the system. And the way he was
You've
mobbed.
You've been waiting all week to say that.
Damn right. The way he was mobbed was just magnificent, wasn't it?
Look, it was a great moment, Tony. No doubt about that with TDK, as you said. And I've just actually had a lovely conversation with Terry De Koning, Tom's father, who played 33 games, I think it was, at the Western Bulldogs, or Footscray as it was in the 80s,
yep.
And was a ruckman himself. He talked about the moment that Tom took that mark early on, that first touch. He said, happened right in front of me, right nice. In front of me. And he said...
off by Lockie O'Brien, was it, or Paddy Dow?
Oh, that's the question I had noticed. I can't... Might have been Paddy.
Yeah.
Might have been Paddy Dow. And he said, He said, when you're a parent watching on, he said, the fear isn't for your boy getting hurt. It's the fear of him not being able to perform on the big stage. And he said for him to take that mark early in the game was such a great thing for the boy's confidence. And he said, I was watching on intently to see what he was going to do with that kick.
Yeah.
He said, because I knew he wasn't going to make the distance, but he put it to the top of the goal square,
yeah.
Not the goal line, he said, because it's easily
easily
thwarted,
yeah.
But put to the top of the square. And he said, I've had a look at the replay of that moment, and he said, you had Charlie Curno, Harry and Cripper all flying for that mark. So he said that ball couldn't have been better placed for those three Carlton players to take that mark. So that was an immediate tick for young Tom De Koning. And so I have the interview on the Carlton website probably later today, Thursday, yeah. Tony.
Carltonfc.com.au.
Yeah, so look out for that one. It was lovely to hear the old man wax lyrical about his boy.
Oh, he'd be very proud. As I say, great reaction. Tone, can we get you 3-2-1s? I'm just going to remind you, we do have a special guest in today. I'm very excited about this. So your 3-2-1s, then we'll preview quickly the Adelaide game and get to our game.
Yes. Well, you've mentioned a couple of players in dispatches, Tony, and hard to argue with you. I've in fact gone with all defenders this week, and I do apologise to the likes of Kieran Byrne and Jakob Wietering, because I thought they were very good.
Yeah.
However, I've given one vote to the Evergreen Blue, Cade Simpson. Great game from Cade. Little big man of the AFL.
The pocket battleship.
Yes. Two votes to Caleb Marchbank. Loved his intercepts.
Yeah.
And he's really growing into that role soon after back. What a goal-to-goal line is being developed there, Tony. It's really something the club can work on from here.
Very classy stuff.
It is. Mm-hmm. And three votes to another old-timer, Dale Thomas.
Oh.
I thought Dale... Look, congratulations to him. I think he's committed for another year, if I read rightly. And he's had a great year for the club, and much maligned. You know, we talk about, people always hark back to the Eddie Betts, move, and no fault of Dale Thomas's, mind you. And he's been superb. He waived that long-term contract in the best interest of the Carlton Football Club, and he's been rewarded with another 12 months, and all power to him. He's a great fellow around the place too, Dale, I don't know if you've had course of meeting, but he's an absolute ripper. He's got a lot of bubble and a bit like yourself, Tone.
Yeah, sure,
very engaging character.
We're on very similar salaries for what we do too. Can I just say exactly. My wife's favourite player. I hear a lot about Daisy Thomas at home. Can I just say, is there a match stat, an official match stat, for avoiding a thrown bottle of water or whatever it was?
Well, credit to Daisy for that. It was the sixth sense. You know, I've been in that situation, actually. The first day I started as a cadet journalist at Truth Newspaper, I had to walk through to the copy desk, which is at the back of the building in West Melbourne, at the back of the house of Stouch down there, Festival Hall.
Yeah.
And I remember I walked in, I was fresh out of school, and I had a tie done up, and I had a three-piece suit. And I was walking to my desk past all these reprobates in this building, and I could sort of remember, hello, there's something coming my way. And I swung my head back just in time to see a coffee cup fly past my nose and smash against the wall. And one of the sub-editors was having a row with one of the journalists. And I can remember that by the time I got to the end of my desk, I undid the top button of my tie and I threw that away. And I knew I just entered the school of hard knocks, Tone, and I thought I'd finished school. You know, I just was out of school. But that was my first experience with the Fourth Estate. Welcome to journalism, son.
Yeah, exactly. I think, well, Daisy probably had a bit of experience dodging glass at the old Collingwood Social Club post-match functions.
No doubt a Bulldog supporter, Tone. I dare say.
Oh, was of course, yes. Come on.
Dispatch the missile?
No, exactly. If it was a Carlton supporter, I would expect at the very least it would have been a Waterford Crystal flute or something like that. Now, the final match of the year against Adelaide. Adelaide have not had the season they expected to have.
No.
You know what? Do you put it down to that crazy pre-season cult camp?
Those lazy, crazy, hazy days of summertime at Adelaide. I don't know what was going on up there. Too smart by half, I think. And it really has permeated the whole place, hasn't it?
Yeah.
They didn't seem to recover from that debacle, the Adelaide players. Some semblance of order was brought back probably, you know, in the second third of the season. But probably the damage that was done, it's fair to say. They've got back on the horse. They seem to be travelling a little bit better in recent weeks. But, yeah, I mean, reigning grand finalists, you would have thought they'd be featuring the September action. So, you know, something's gone awry. But they'll be a formidable opponent next week.
Yes, there's no
just
doubt
the same.
7:25 p.m. Saturday at Etihad Stadium, last time we met. Was round seven. It was in Adelaide at the beautiful Adelaide Oval. 55 point loss to the Baggers. In terms of injuries, Pusser Graham has a fitness test, and Garlett, his shoulder means he's out for the week, but he will be back for the start of the pre-season. They have a potent forward line. That's going to be the thing we have to shut down.
Yeah, so I suppose the Texans still out through suspension, isn't he? So there's probably one player that we don't have to worry about up front. But look, you know, as I said earlier, Tone, in terms of the Western Bulldogs encounter, all our backs performed admirably, I thought, at the weekend. And look, you know, we've talked about De Conning and, you know, we see the ongoing progress of Harry Mackay and Charlie. I think that's what we take away from the year. You know, these young blokes are getting games, more games, and with every quarter, it seems, they seem to be really, you know, emerging as serious top-end talent. So I think that's when we reflect on, you know, the season that was, yes, in terms of ladder position, it could always be better. But there have been little wins along the way. You know, I think Brendan Bolton from day one always said that you have to look for these little wins, I suppose, as they are on the field, and the fortunes of the young players as they come through. And I suppose that's what we take away most from 2018, the emergence of some of these, you know, these high-end draftees that are obviously going to be there for the long haul for the Carlton Football Club.
Indeed, Tone. And look, emblematic of the horror run of injuries, ASOS, he is retiring. We didn't get to see him at his full magnificent potential, or enough of it, I don't think. I think what we saw was enough to get us very excited, but we wish him all the very best.
I'm glad you brought up his name, because when I think of Alex Silvani, I think of the game against Sydney, which I think was his first game for Carlton, where he absolutely pants Buddy Franklin at the MCG.
Did.
Do you remember that game?
Yes.
And it's very rare that you see a player of Lance Franklin's capability humble the way he was that day. And it's just such a great shame that the great strength of Alex Silvani, his ferocious competitive nature, has probably in fact brought about his undoing. Because even at Fremantle, I mean, I think he only played 60 games there, and even less here at Carlton. But there was a player that truly led by example.
Yeah.
And if I could be so bold, Tony, there was a tweet sent out by Matt DeBoer, an old teammate at Frio, who said this week of Alex Silvani: one of the toughest, most brutal and underrated defenders to play, will be successful at whatever he does next as long as he ditches the trackies. Enjoy the burgers, RAS, and four-wheel drive adventures in retirement, mate. Now, RAS, he is spelled W-R-A-S-S-E, and I thought it was an error on Twitter. I thought he meant RAPS until I Googled RAS and found out it was a most delightful-looking fish. But there's an in-joke there because Devore and Alex Silvani go fishing, and RAS, while it looks good, is absolutely shocking eating. And apparently Alex has got a great habit of hauling the RAS in. So I dare say there's going to be a lot of fishing expeditions happening now that Alex Silvani's retired. I just bumped into him. He came back for the last training session to watch the boys go through their paces. He's more than likely heading back to WA in the new year with his wife, who is West Australian. They've just had a little daughter. But he has told me that he will be there on the terraces supporting the Blues whenever they're on the Nullarbor on their way to Perth. So a great, great competitor. Yeah. Sadly lost to the game.
Yeah, he really is. The handful of games he had for us were a joy and a delight to watch. And on one level, I'm gutted that he's going. So all the very best in retirement, ASOS. Now, our guest, Tone, has been very patient. He's brought in one hell of a book.
What a tome. Look at that.
Well, the book is called The Norm Smith Medalists. Why on earth would that be of interest to the Carlton podcast, I ask you? Well, I tell you, because there are some magnificent stories about men who have not only worn the navy blue, but brought great honour to it on the biggest game of the year. Dan Eady is its author. He joins us now. G'day, Dan.
G'day, Tone and Tone. It's great to be here.
Well, Dan, it's a bit hard to know where to start. I mean, the North Smith Medal is now, 40 years old? And, of course, the great Wayne Harms was the first recipient of the North Smith Medal. Look, it's hard to know where to begin and end with this interview with you today. But maybe you should open by just talking about the exercise itself of sourcing all the North Smith medalists, how long the book has been in the pipeline, you know, and where your research actually took you.
Yeah, oh, thanks. Yeah, no, it's been fascinating. Like all of us, you grew up idolising the feats of the players on grand final day, and as a kid I was always fascinated by it. And the Norm Smith medalists, used to, after the game you'd go out in the backyard and try and emulate whoever'd won the Norm Smith against your brothers in the backyard, so that was always fun. So always had an interest, a fascination in the medal, and then I proposed the idea to my publisher, Jeff Slattery, a couple of years ago, and there's too many projects on the go, I think, so it was put on hold. And then Wayne Harms had that shock heart attack last year, and I think that sort of rejigged Jeff's memory, and he thought, we better get onto this, because being the first one, we want to make sure that Harms, he gets well and we can have a chat to him. So it really grew from there. So it probably took me 12 months from when Jeff said get onto it. So there's 37 winners, and Morris,
starting with the number 37.
Exactly, yeah. Nice. And the connection is remarkable because Harmsy's great uncle was Norm Smith, so he was presented the award by Norm's widow, Marge. So real family connection. And then Peter Smith, the son, presented it to Bruce Doole in 1981. So there's been a real family affair. So started there, and as I said, there's 37 winners. Maurice Rioli's the only one who's passed away in 1982 against the Blues. And so I got to about 26 of the 36, and there's a handful that were just impossible to tie down. Michael Long and Gary Ablett Sr. and obviously Bruce Doole never speaks to anyone. So I got to most, and the ones I didn't get to, I interviewed their coaches or their teammates and piece their stories together that way. So amazing journey, yeah.
That's an amazing journey. Just on the late Maurice Rioli, did he leave anything behind on the record in terms of winning the North Smith? Was there records you were able to draw on there or not?
Yeah, there's an interview he did with Rhett Bartlett for Great History that Rhett put together on the Tigers. So I was able to draw a little bit from that. But Phil Egan played with Maurice at Richmond, so they became best friends, and so I got to have a good chat with with him about that, and also a handful of other guys who played with or against him, including Francis Burke coached him and Mel Brown coached him over in WA. So, yeah, got some good stories on Morris.
We're going to talk mainly, obviously, about Carlton players who got it. Let's talk about David Rees-Jones, who got his in 1987. What were his recollections?
Yeah, they were pretty sharp. He played on Gary Ayres in the 86 grand final, and Ayres won the Norm Smith, so he was, he had a bit of ground to make up the next year.
Bruce Dill's last game too.
Exactly, played on Dunstall, I think, that day, and they got
refused
done.
Refused to be carried off. Dan Brewster walked up the race. He would not be carried off. He was so disappointed. He was a proud man.
Yeah, well, that sums up what he was like, doesn't it? So, Reece really good. He found out he was playing on Dermot Brereton maybe a couple of days before the game or even the night before. It was Robert Walls left it to the last minute to tell him that he's on the biggest name in the game. So, and, I mean, you guys have probably watched it 100 times, but he was absolutely outstanding that day, and he kept Dermy goalless for the only time all year, which was remarkable. Dermy, it was a really uncharacteristic performance by Dermy, but every time it hit the ground, Reece was there to just take it away, and he's outstanding. So,
does an interview with Dermy actually feature in the book?
The guys I interviewed, each chapter that I interviewed, the guys that's told in their words.
Yep.
And the ones that I couldn't interview, then I tell it as an actual story, I guess, as such, but and tie in the interviews here and there. But so with Reece, he was very forthcoming with his memories. We met at Mill Hanna's Cafe in Brunswick Street. Yeah, we met there, and a bit hard to hear the audio on the tapes. It was a pretty loud cafe in there, but we had a good chat, and he sent me a good photo of him with the book the other day, which was great. So
did he lead you to the upstairs room? There's a good room up above.
No,
the
we sat down the bottom. Oh, yeah, we didn't get the...
Yeah, right. Massive mega deals have been hatched up there.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's a good spot.
The 87 players reunion was there.
Was there?
You mentioned Dermy having a shocker. We know and he was a big occasion player. He was one of the game's absolute all-time greats. But was there a common thread that comes through with Norm Smith's medalists? Was it just something that happened to gel on the day where they just... everything came together and they ended up playing a great game? Because we know great players can put in bad performances. Like Dermy is the example I just mentioned. Was there a common thread amongst players?
They're all very... proud and driven players anyway. I mean, most didn't go into it thinking they were going to be best on ground. There's only two blokes who said to me that during the games that they won it in, they felt they were going to win it.
And can we have those names?
Yeah,
one play for Carlton?
One played for Carlton in about 95.
It seems like something
I nearly fell off my chair.
Great Greg Williams and Cyril Rioli as well just said, I felt it was a good chance to win it. So, but no one really went in saying I'm going to win it at the start of the day. I mean, Kevin Bartlett won the second one in 1980, and he said when the game was over, I didn't even know there was a medal. Like, it was still so early days. So most were shocked when they were told that they were about to win it. When the AFL official comes up and speaks to them before the podium. So most were shocked. But as you know, with all those Carlton blokes, driven, big game performers, proud, don't want to let their team down. And so that's probably what the similarity, you know. Although the Bulldogs, Jason Johannesson a couple of years ago said before the game, when they were all warming up out on the MCG, he laid down on the turf and said, I got myself a tan. That was his pre-game psych up. So they're all very different characters, that's for sure, but the drive to want to perform.
Dan, a few little observations. When you talked about Williams, I don't know if you had an opportunity to see it. It's only just gone up, but there's a great a little bit of video on the Carlton FC website at the moment, driving with Sam Pang. And Diesel's behind the wheel, and there's a moment about him talking about his possessions and he touches in footy, you know, where he said that, you know, if I got to the third quarter with 35 touches, he said, I made a point of getting 45. He said possessions meant everything to him, And so he said maybe that was what separated him. He said because a lot of players probably 35 touches at three-quarter time sort of rest on their laurels a bit. But he went again. So it's just great, you know, and you've touched on that in your answers earlier about the psychology of these guys and the mindset and how driven they were. There's another just question about Bruce Doole's win of the Norm Smith in 81, Dan. Interestingly enough, that came on Craig Davis, who himself was a former Carlton player, playing for Collingwood that particular day. But Bruce, had a pretty good day in 81.
He was terrific. Just quickly on Williams, Greg, there's a quote in the book that says, Greg said, I was all about my possessions and about checking the newspaper to make sure I had the most. So he was. That was a really internal drive, which I'd never heard from another player. Normally they wouldn't talk about that. Yeah. But so that
and a modest figure too. I can remember in his own tome, Greg Weaver's story, there's a chapter in there which is headlined, How I Bagged My Second Brownlow Medal. You can say that if you won a couple.
Well, you almost won three, let's be honest.
Let's not go there.
Which is covered in the book, isn't it? The 44 possession game that didn't get him a Brownlow vote.
And a big hello to John Russo.
Oh,
yes, boy. I had to. I'll admit that there's some stuff edited out that we would have loved to have put in that Greg was happy for me to put in, but Jeff said
to regurgitate that stuff off the cutting room floor, Dan. Go for your life.
I might get in a bit of trouble with the law if I try and accuse the people of what Greg said. But just on Dooley, he quite the opposite of Greg, really, wasn't he? It wasn't about stats and it wasn't about pumping himself up, I guess, he was such a unique character, and all his teammates speak so fondly of him, whether they played one game or 300 games. As you know from the Larrikins and Legends book I wrote, that the players and the coaches just adored him, even though he never said a word to anyone, just the most reliable player, and he was Mr. Reliable in that 81 grand final.
He was indeed. Can I ask you, Dan, given your research, which has been quite extensive, obviously, and you've looked at all the winners in totality, I suspect you've probably had occasion to review videos of most of the grand finals. Can you say in your own heart of hearts that, by and large, the selectors got each winner right?
It's an interesting question, that one, and certainly don't want to do an injustice to the ones to everyone who won it. I watched every game. Fortunately, they're all in the DVD era, so I've studied every game and every possession. And it's interesting. There's some that are probably questionable. I won't name names, but there's some where you look
at clubs.
I better not. I better not. Although I will say, brilliant as Morris Rioli was in 1982, there's a couple of Carlton blokes who were pretty good as well. We won't name Wayne Johnston or Ken Hunter or anyone, but a couple of guys. But we can get the Brownlow Medal vote tallies for every year going back to 1924. The Norm Smith, you can only get the official vote tallies since 2003. I reckon. The AFL does not have any tallies from 79 through really? To... So I know all the judges for each year, but I don't know, and most couldn't remember who they voted for. But so what I did for the early ones was I went through all the newspapers and selected might have been the Herald, and you'd put their votes in for the day and to show a rough idea of who were the good players by those judges. And then I put the official votes in for the more recent guys. And... there's a few that it's quite interesting that show. I don't think Kevin Bartlett was in the top two or three in that newspaper's votes, and a few others as well. So it was interesting.
So speaking about that leads to my next question. I suspect from the period 1966 to 1978 that Seven basically covered it, all of those grand finals. And so they're still on record. And yet that's that black hole where the Norm Smith is not presented. My reason for this question is that last week at the 68 reunion, Tony and I had the great pleasure to interview Gary Crane, who is generally considered to have been the best player of field in that 68 grand final. And I think Tony may have asked him the question, what are your thoughts on retrospective Norm Smith's being presented? And he said, wouldn't that be lovely? He said, but I doubt that it would happen. Do you feel that there is scope for retrospective Norm Smith medals to be awarded to players in that particular era that have played well in grand finals?
You think with the TV vision that would help. I think Norm Smith died in 73, I think. So I wonder whether they'd only go back to when he passed away. You know, like the John Colmer medal only starts... How far back does it go? I think it only starts when he...
From when he died, maybe?
Or they might have retrospective back to when he was playing. I'm not sure. But there's a couple of other awards where that's the case, where they only start from when that person passed on or whatever. Yep. So I wonder whether they would go further back than 73-ish.
Yes.
But it'd be great. I think they have done look-backs on in the Herald Sun and a couple of things where they have gone back to 70 grand final and all those ones and done their official votes, if you want to call it. It would be good, though, that maybe we should champion that, because I know Brent Croswell would be happy if we did that.
Very true.
I think there's something to be said for that. From your point of view, we're speaking to Dan Eddy, by the way, and the book is The Norm Smith Medalists. Is there one game that you think would stand head and shoulders maybe above others or as first amongst equals as just an incredible individual performance that contains elements, you know, maybe a player that just rejuvenated his team when the team needed to be hauled across the line? Or is there one individual performance you think kind of stands out?
Yeah, well, it's not Carlton, but I certainly Gary Ablett in 89, I think that stands out at the top of the... There's some great performances. I mean, Simon Black had 39 touches in 2003 and... Tony Shaw was brilliant in 1990, and I think Harmsy turns the match in 79. Mm. He's too humble to admit that. He reckons he only got the medal because of his family connection. I doubt whether they would have even known his connection at the time when they voted. And I've studied the game, and there's no question that he turns the momentum of the game. Be like Billy Duckworth at Essendon in 84. They may not have had the most stats, but they had the impact on the day. So those things stand out.
And it's funny, Dan, that if you look at Wayne Harms in 82, that pivotal moment where they put him back onto KB, he was looking threatening early.
Yeah.
And Wayne Harms really negated Bartlett's influence. And you think back to that game, a three-goal game, it's a good game, it was tight, that... You know, he stands pretty tall in big games, doesn't he, W. Harms? And he was a great player in that one.
Yeah, amazing. You look at him today and he's the most unlikely character to have been such a champion. But I remember Parco saying when he first got to Carlton in the early in 81, and he said, I went to the first training out at Aberfeldy Track out there at...
Cross Keys or whatever
it was. Near there, and he said... I walk in and there's Harms and Sheldon and they're leaping over things the size of them and they're doing all these acrobatic... He was blown away by how acrobatic Harms was and how athletic. And Harms, he'd probably laugh today if we said you were an athletic player because he doesn't look it anymore, but he was, and he was brilliant. He was a match winner, wasn't he?
He was. I was probably a bit unfair with that question earlier about, you know, which players you think, you know, may not have been worthy winners. So... I'll phrase it another way. Who are the unluckiest players, do you think, not to have won a Norm Smith?
Jason Graham in 2009. He's the only player from the votes that we know, anyway, who tied first but lost on a countback to Paul Chapman. Now, what's interesting about that is Chapman got... There's five judges and Chapman got three votes, so he got nine votes. But Graham got votes off all five judges, just... It added up to nine, so he didn't have as many three votes. So he actually missed out, even though he got more judges thought he played well. Yes. So it was really, that was probably the stiff one, I reckon, where he'd be feeling a bit... They lost the game as well, so he's probably a bit...
So they'll award two Brownlows, but not two Norm Smiths.
Yeah, I wonder whether down the track they'll do that one, because they should, yeah.
And interestingly, you talk about Ablett as probably the greatest performance of any Norm Smith medalist in a team that lost too, it should be said, and the same with Maurice Rioli. Do you have a view on that? I mean, should the Norm Smith medalist feature in the winning team, or are you quite happy with the way they've got it?
I think if it's a close... You know, there isn't an absolute standout. I've got no problem with it. I thought there was standouts in 82, and that's, again, Morris did some great things, but he did the great things when Hunter was off the field knocked out, and then you come back on twice.
Yes.
And so it was, and same with, like, Ablett's had to win it. He just had to.
Yeah.
Even though Hawks controlled most of the day, he had to win it. So there's a couple like that, but the Bucks, Nathan Buckley winning in 2002, they just lost to Brisbane. Michael Voss had a great last couple of minutes, and the judges had already made their votes by then, and Bucks beat Vossi by a couple of votes, I think. So that was a controversial one, but Bucks played a great game, so it's not like he shouldn't have. And Juddy got it for West Coast in 2005 when they lost to Sydney by 4 points.
Well, I would imagine the theme amongst Naismith medalists in losing teams would be that they, no matter how proud they are to actually have the medal, they would willingly trade it in a heartbeat for the... for the premiership medallion.
For sure, and that's why it's probably a bittersweet memory. I mean, Buck said he only talks about it when someone like me brings it up to him, and he had a bit of a laugh. But he took it off when he was walking off the podium. He took it off his neck just because of it wasn't something to celebrate at the time. And they look back now and they're very proud that they've got it. But there's a bittersweet thing. It'd be interesting with Maurice Rioli because, unlike Juddy, he never played in a premiership. And, you know, so whether they viewed that higher. Byron Pickett won his in 2004, and he's so thrilled even today to have won it, really. And David Rhys-Jones, I won't swear on air, but David Rhys-Jones says that he was the one, he'd be just known as a D-head who didn't who got suspended 25 times as opposed to being a Naismith medalist. So that's significant for these guys. It's huge, even whether you won or lost, yeah.
Dan, it's been fascinating to hear you relate tales so extensively in terms of your research for the Naismith Medal, the medalist, the book you've written. But I know that you have been working on another project, and this really is a quite incredible project. You're researching the life and times of the great Alex Jezolenko. It's hard to know where to begin and end with Jezza. I have to commend you for taking this on because as a great Carlton supporter, it was always a pipe dream I had to get Jez's story down, and he was always reluctant to do it. But look, can you talk a little bit about how this came about, and then we'll talk a little bit about the story that you're uncovering along the way.
Yeah, thanks, mate. Yeah, no, it's been great having your help along the way too, because I know it's so close to your heart and to the club's heart, the great man. So I've been very lucky. Certainly no mention of books at this stage. I'm hoping to soften him up, the great Jezza, one day. But he's at least allowed me to interview him a few times for the sake of a university thesis. So been very lucky. And his family, his daughters, Kate and Sally, have been involved. And the family history is just fascinating. And, yeah, I just took the idea that I wanted to... do Jezza as a PhD to Federation University, and the man I spoke to there, Keir Reeves, is a massive Carlton fan. He probably could have written it himself, so he jumped at that. So I got a 3-year scholarship to research that. I'm in the third year now, and really delved into his migrant journey, which I knew nothing about. And there's a movie just in that, I think. It's pretty amazing, as you know. So. And then everything that happens after that is just the bonus, the fact that his family survives through the Europe period under Hitler and Stalin and all the horrors of that, and miss a couple of boats coming out to us to different countries, and then the third boat came to Australia. So we shouldn't have even got him, so we're pretty lucky.
It's absolutely staggering, you know, and I reading between the lines and in terms of the extracts you've sent me, it seemed that that Alex's, you know, mother and father for... most of their lives, perhaps all of their lives, basically bottled the stories up, that they rarely talked about their lives in Europe. And yet when you read, as you've articulated, what was happening in Europe at that particular time, you can understand why they would have bottled it away. It was the horrors that they must have encountered were unspeakable, weren't they?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. And as a researcher, I was fortunate that Alex's oldest daughter, Sally, had a few chats with her nan while she was still alive, and they'd start to discuss a little bit of what went on, and as soon as Alex entered the room, she'd change the subject to cooking or something, you know, like she just did not want her children... I've been trying to track down Jez's sister, Larissa, and I hope I can still do that. And if I can, maybe she spoke with her mum about it, but certainly Alex, she never gave much away at all, hardly anything. So, and looking into the history of it is just horrific, how they survived through being starved and forced to flee and in prison. Jez was born in a prison camp in Austria, in beautiful Salzburg. You know, even when he comes out to Australia at three and they go to Canberra, he's in a camp environment for another 3 or 4 years. So his first 6 or 7 years of his life are in a sort of camp settlement environment. So it's hard to relate to that.
Yes. And then the good story is, though, that in Canberra, he seems to be accepted into the fold from the outset. He assimilates really well. He's taken by his mates at school. And, of course, from day one, you've identified that he just excelled in sport, whatever it was. He was able to turn his hand to it, and he was on another level, wasn't he?
Yeah, his friends say the lucky bugger. He got all the... So we'd be busting our backsides at practice or whatever, and he'd just be doing it with ease. So it just, yeah, remarkable how it all just came to him. He could leap doing the high jump really well, and he couldn't swim. They said he couldn't swim very well, but he tried hard and got better at it. But he wasn't a great swimmer, but they reckon he could have played basketball for Australia. An Australian player said there's three blokes in this team here that could go on and play for Australia, and he was one of them. They reckon he could play soccer. He represented the soccer team, and his season or two playing rugby union for the St Edmunds College in Canberra, they'd just give the ball to him and say go, and if they got 40 points, he got 35 of them. Like, he was that, and that's where he learned his fend off and that strength in legs to break tackles and stand up.
One time before Dustin Martin.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's right. And so he learned all that stuff, and his jumping for marking all comes from that high jump and the athletics. He was good at the hop, step and jump and the long jump. So he just had that in him. He puts it down to simply DNA, but countless hours of just practicing without realising he's practicing, I reckon, played a big part in that. But and there's one more myth, mate, that all the records say that he didn't touch a football until he was 14. But I've found out that he was doing it by 12. So even that's still late for you and me. We were doing it probably at two. But so he's But there is a few little myths that go on around his development that we've been able to find out, which is
so. You and I had 10 years head start to it. We were still
trying to catch up,
grab his bootlaces, weren't we? Dan, then you talk about his time at Eastlake, you know, and the successes at Eastlake, and again, obviously, how as his time in football continued, he really started to come into prominence, and it's fascinating to learn of the machinations which led to him actually coming to Carlton. By rights, he shouldn't have been at Carlton, should he?
No, if North Melbourne had have done it the right way, and Alan Aylett still bemoans the fact that they probably tried to pursue him. I was spoken with a couple of his teammates from Eastlake who remember the first time North approached him. They were on a end-of-season trip at the Gold Coast, and they went about it the wrong way, and Jez had just signed the form so they'd nick off, but not realising what it was, but the form was null and void. But I thought then Carlton must have done the honourable thing and got him the right way, but as it turns out, they went about it. It was a bit of in the know who you knew, and I know there was some heavy people up in Parliament, like Don Chip, and Robert Menzies was a Carlton man as well, and John Nicholls said he spoke to Don about getting him down here, but he was also what George Harris and the guys did to manipulate the rules a little bit to secretly get him, and then the rules came in, and a bit like North with their 10-year rule where they got a bit of forewarning what was going to happen, and yeah, that'll be all in the story. But it's remarkable that he ends up at Carlton, and the person he asked was his wife Anne's, or then his girlfriend Anne's, future father-in-law, and he was an Essendon supporter, and he had every chance to say go to the Bombers, so well, that could have been different again, and it was probably lucky that Tom Carroll left Carlton in 62-3-ish, somewhere then, and there was that gaping hole in the forward line, and you know, so that's why his father-in-law said go to Carlton because you'll get a game in that forward line because they don't have anyone. So
unbelievable. It is unbelievable. We could, again, talk for hours about Alex Jesolenko, and your research is quite meticulous and extensive, and I know you're still ploughing on. But have you researched enough, Dan, to articulate your thoughts on who Alex Jesolenko is, like as a person, as a player? You know, if you had to describe him, what would you say?
He just loved playing with his... Before Ron Barassi probably influenced him, certainly at Eastlake, he just loved playing with his mates. He was reluctant to even play senior footy until his mates were allowed to play with him. You know, like he just enjoyed playing. He liked being out of the house playing, and that followed through until even his first... When he started at Carlton, that was more his philosophy, I think. And then Brass said, no, I do things a bit different here. And so, but even then, after the first 12 months, Brass and him came to an agreement that he shouldn't be overtrained. And some of his teammates joked that might have been a bit of teacher's pet stuff. But he knew what worked for his body. And he just, this is probably like Buddy Franklin today, you know how your body works. And for him, that worked for him. But in terms of a bloke, it's interesting. He is a hard person to know, and you'd probably found that too in all your dealings as well. But his daughter, Kate, says, by far and above the nicest man I've ever met in my life. Like, just, it's really humble, quiet. You go to his house for an interview and there's not, you wouldn't know he played footy. There's not one picture, not one bit of memorabilia, nothing up in the house. So very humble. And as we touched on with his family, coming from nothing, I don't think possessions and pumping yourself up, and, you know, he was never comfortable in the media. He did it, and he had periods where he probably made good money out of doing it, but it wasn't something he championed himself. I imagine Anne probably pushed that more than Alex, and having Mike Williamson as a friend as well. And today he's more Barry Gill. He's great mates with Barry Gill, and they go off all around Australia on fishing trips, and they'll go to a spot where no one else is, you know. He just loves to get away, and whether they probably have a few more cans than they do catch fish, but Barry says he's a terrible fisherman, but but it's such special times, so that is probably where he's at now. And it's great that he turns up to a few functions now for the Carlton people. It's fantastic. But very humble, quiet man, even though he's the, you know, the superstar as such, you know. So it's an interesting conundrum that with that personality.
It's right, Dan. You know, he asked Jesu himself, and he probably wonder what all the fuss is about. But, you know, for someone like myself, the mere mention of his name evokes so many, you know, great memories, and it sort of sends tingles up the spine just thinking about the player he was, and you know, the prodigious ability he had as a player, and one of the all-time greats in league football, that is for sure. And look, all power to you for what you've done. It's an important story. It's a great European story. It's an even greater Australian story. And you know, if ever the thesis is available for us, we would love to absolutely reproduce it, and with the great man's consent, of course. Yeah. That might be a bit harder, but look. Dan, thanks very much for sharing your memories of the process in both the Norm Smith Medalist book, which is a great tome, and I'm really happy that it's selling well, and, of course, the story of the great Alex Jesolenko. I'm sure there's a few more books in the pipeline for you.
There is. There's a lot of Carlton personalities we still need to write about, don't we?
Well, that's it. That's it. You know, and so keep at it. Thanks again for coming in. Always great to reminisce with you, and all power to you for the research ahead.
Yeah, I appreciate the support of Carlton Footy Club. It's great that I can help tell a few of their great stories. You know, and there'll be a few more soon with Cripps and a few of those guys, hopefully, as well.
The book is The Norm Smith Medalist, The Players Who Delivered on Football's Grandest Stage. It's forwarded by Greg Williams, whose modesty shines through. It's by Dan Eddy. He's been our guest today. Thank you so much for coming in, Dan.
I appreciate it, guys. Thanks for having me.
Great Always fun. Great to have you. You're a friend of the podcast, and we look forward to having you back in season 2019. Tone, go Blues against Adelaide. We expect a good turnout for the last game of the season. Hopefully a win. And we want to make Bryce Gibbs and Sam Jacobs bitterly regret their decisions And we
and don't forget the little bloke in the forward pocket.
Oh, yes, that's true. Oh, Lord. Anyway, but we will catch you next week for the last episode of The Two Tones.
Where we will hopefully have in the studio our winner, the Two Tones medal for 2018.
I wonder who that could be. Anyway, go Blues, and we'll catch you next week.
Bye-bye.